I have here a number of forms which will allow both you and Ms. Davis to remain financially mobile while assuring that neither of you will have unfair access to the funds you both worked so hard to accumulate, Humboldt said. I also have preliminary court notifications which need to be signed by you and forms that will allow us to put your bonds and T-bills in an escrow account until your current situation is settled by the court. I opened my mouth to tell him I wasn't going to sign anything, and if that meant the meeting was over, so be it, but I didn't get out so much as a single word. Before I could, I was interrupted by the maitre d'. He was screaming as well as talking. It was as if he had a belly full of steam and a tea kettle whistle caught in his throat. That dog! Eee! I told you time and time again about that dog! Eee! All that time I can't sleep! Eee! She say cut your face, that cunt! Eee! How you tease me! Eee! And now you bring that dog in here! Eee! The room fell silent at once, of course. Diners looking up in astonishment from their meals or their conversations as the thin, pale, black-clad figure came stalking across the room with its face outthrust and its long, stork-like legs scissoring. The maitre d's bow tie had turned a full 90 degrees from its normal position, so it now looked like the hands of a clock indicating the hour of 6. It was me he was looking at, me he was approaching. I stared at him, feeling almost hypnotized. It was like one of those dreams where you discover that you haven't studied for the bar exam you're supposed to take, or that you're attending a White House dinner in your honor with no clothes on. And I might have stayed that way if Humboldt hadn't moved. I heard his chair scrape back and glanced at him. He was standing up, his napkin held loosely in one hand. He looked surprised, but he also looked furious. I suddenly realized two things, that he was drunk, quite drunk, in fact, and that he saw this as a smirch on both his hospitality and his competence. He had chosen the restaurant, after all, and now look, the master of ceremonies had gone bonkers. Eee! I teach you! For the last time, I teach you! See here, you idiot, Humboldt said, turning to face him, and the maitre d' brought his left hand out from behind his back. In it was the largest butcher knife I have ever seen. It had to have been 2 feet long, with the top part of its cutting edge slightly belled, like a cutlass in an old pirate movie. Look out, I yelled at Humboldt, and at one of the tables against the wall, a skinny man in rimless spectacles screamed, ejecting a mouthful of chewed brown fragments of food onto the tablecloth in front of him. Humboldt seemed to hear neither my yell or the other man's scream. He was frowning thunderously at the maitre d'. You don't need to expect to see me in here again if this is the way, Humboldt began. Eee! Eee! The maitre d' screamed and swung the butcher knife flat through the air. It made a kind of whickering sound, like a whispered sentence. The period was the sound of the blade burying itself in William Humboldt's right cheek. Blood exploded out of the wound in a furious spray of tiny droplets. They decorated the tablecloth in a fan-shaped stipplework, and I clearly saw, I will never forget it, one bright red drop fall into my water glass and then dive for the bottom with a pinkish filament like a tail stretching out behind it. It looked like a bloody tadpole. Humboldt's cheek snapped open, revealing his teeth. And as he clapped his hand to the gouting wound, I saw something pinkish-white lying on the shoulder of his charcoal-gray suit coat. It wasn't until the whole thing was over that I realized it must have been his earlobe. "Tell this in your ears!" the maitre d' screamed furiously at Diane's bleeding lawyer, who stood there with one hand clapped to his cheek. Except for the blood pouring over and between his fingers, Humboldt looked weirdly like Jack Benny doing one of his famous double takes. Call this to your hateful tattletale friends of the street, you misery, eee, dog lover. Now other people were screaming, mostly at the sight of the blood, I think. Humboldt was a big man, and he was bleeding like a stuck pig. I could hear it pattering on the floor like water from a broken pipe, and the front of his white shirt was now red. His tie, which had been red to start with, was now black. Steve, Diane said. Stephen? A man and a woman had been having lunch at the table behind her and slightly to her left. Now the man, about 30 and handsome in the way George Hamilton used to be, bolted to his feet and ran toward the front of the restaurant. "Troy, don't go without me," his date screamed, but Troy never looked back. He'd forgotten all about a library book he was supposed to return, it seemed, or maybe about how he'd promised to wax the car. If there had been a paralysis in the room, I can't actually say if there was or not, although I seem to have seen a great deal and to remember it all, that broke it. There were more screams and other people got up. Several tables were overturned, glasses and china shattered on the floor. I saw a man with his arm around the waist of his female companion hurry past behind the maitre d'. Her hand was clamped into his shoulder like a claw. For a moment, her eyes met mine, and they were as empty as the eyes of a Greek bust. Her face was dead pale, hag-like with horror. All of this might have happened in 10 seconds, or maybe 20. I remember it like a series of photographs or film strips, but it has no timeline. Time ceased to exist for me at the moment Alfalfa the maitre d' brought his left hand out from behind his back and I saw the butcher knife. During that time, the man in the tuxedo continued to spew out a confusion of words in his special maitre d's language, the one that old girlfriend of mine had called snooty. Some of it really was a foreign language. Some of it was English, but completely without sense, and some of it was striking, almost haunting. Much of it I can't remember. What I can remember, I suppose I'll never forget. Humboldt staggered backward, still holding his lacerated cheek. The backs of his knees struck the seat of his chair, and he sat down heavily on it. He looks like someone who's just been told he's disinherited, I thought. He started to turn toward Diane and me, his eyes wide and shocked. I had time to see there were tears spilling out of them, and then the maitre d' wrapped both hands around the handle of the butcher knife and buried it in the center of Humboldt's head. It made a sound like someone whacking a pile of towels with a cane. "Boot!" Humboldt cried. I'm quite sure that's what his last word on planet Earth was. Boot. Then his weeping eyes rolled up to whites, and he slumped forward onto his plate, sweeping his own glassware off the table and onto the floor with one outflung hand. As this happened, the maitre d', all his hair sticking up and back now, not just some of it, pried the long knife out of his head. Blood sprayed out of the head wound in a kind of vertical curtain and splashed the front of Diane's dress. She raised her hands to her shoulders with the palms turned out once again, but this time it was in horror rather than exasperation. She shrieked and then clapped her blood-spattered hands to her face, over her eyes. The maitre d' paid no attention to her. Instead, he turned to me. "That dog of yours," he said, speaking in an almost conversational tone. He registered absolutely no interest in or even knowledge of the screaming, terrified people stampeding behind him toward the doors. His eyes were very large, very dark. They looked brown to me again, but there seemed to be black circles around the irises. "That dog of yours is so much rage. All the radio of Coney Island don't make up to that dog, you motherfucker." I had the umbrella in my hand, and the one thing I can't remember, no matter how hard I try, is when I grabbed it. I think it must have been while Humboldt was standing transfixed by the realization that his mouth had been expanded by 8 inches or so, but I simply can't remember. It was in my hand, though, the price tag sticking out of the bottom of my fist, and when the maitre d' bent forward as if bowing and ran the knife through the air at me, meaning, I think, to bury it in my throat, I raised it and brought it down on his wrist like an old-time teacher whacking an unruly pupil with his hickory stick. "Ud!" the maitre d' grunted as his hand was driven sharply down and the blade meant for my throat plowed through the soggy pinkish tablecloth instead. He held on, though, and pulled it back. If I'd tried to hit his knife hand again, I'm sure I would have missed, but I didn't. I swung at his face and fetched him an excellent lick, as excellent a lick as one can administer with an umbrella anyway, up the side of his head. And, as I did, the umbrella popped open like the visual punchline of a slapstick act. I didn't think it was funny, though. The bloom of the umbrella hid him from me completely as he staggered backward with his free hand flying up to the place where I'd hit him, and I didn't like not being able to see him. I grabbed Diane's wrist and yanked her to her feet. She came without a word, took a step toward me, then stumbled on her high heels and fell clumsily into my arms. I was aware of her breasts pushing against me and the warm, wet clamminess over them. "Eee! You boinker!" the maitre d' screamed. Or perhaps it was boinger he called me. It probably doesn't matter. I know that. And yet, it quite often seems to me that it does. Late at night, the little questions haunt me as much as the big ones. "You boinking bastard! All those radios! Hush do baba! Fuck Cousin Brucey! Fuck you!" He started around the table toward us. The area behind him was completely empty now and looked like the aftermath of a brawl in a Western movie saloon. My umbrella was still lying on the table with the open top jutting off the far side, and the maitre d' bumped it with his hip. It fell off in front of him, and while he kicked it aside, I set Diane back on her feet and pulled her toward the far side of the room. The front door was no good. It was probably too far away in any case, but even if we could get there, it was still jammed tight with frightened, screaming people. If he wanted me, or both of us, he would have no trouble catching us and carving us like a couple of turkeys. "Bugs! You bugs! Eee! So much for your dog, eh? So much for your barking dog!" "Make him stop," Diane screamed. "Oh, Jesus, he's going to kill us both. Make him stop." "I rot you, you abominations!" Closer now. The umbrella hadn't held him up for long, that was for sure. "I rot you all!" I saw three doors, two of them facing each other, in a small alcove where there was also a pay telephone. Men's and women's rooms. No good. I dragged her toward the third door and shoved through it into a world of clean green tiles, strong fluorescent light, gleaming chrome, and steamy odors of food. The smell of salmon dominated. Humboldt had never gotten a chance to ask about the specials, but I thought I knew what at least one of them had been. A waiter was standing there with a loaded tray balanced on the flat of one hand, his mouth agape and his eyes wide. He looked like Gimple the Fool in that Isaac Singer story. "What?" he said, and then I shoved him aside. The tray went flying, with plates and glassware shattering against the wall. "Hey!" a man yelled. He was huge, wearing a white smock and a white chef's hat like a cloud. There was a red bandana around his neck, and in one hand he held a ladle that was dripping some sort of brown sauce. "Hey, you can't come in here like a dat." "We have to get out," I said. "He's crazy. He's..." An idea struck me then, a way of explaining without explaining, and I put my hand over Diane's left breast for a moment, on the soaked cloth of her dress. It was the last time I ever touched her intimately, and I don't know if it felt good or not. I held my hand out to the chef, showing him a palm streaked with Humboldt's blood. "Good Christ," he said. "Here, in at the back." At that instant, the door we'd come through burst open again, and the maitre d' rolled in, eyes wild, hair sticking out everywhere like fur on a hedgehog that's tucked itself into a ball. He looked around, saw the waiter, dismissed him, saw me, and rushed at me. I bolted again, dragging Diane with me, shoving blindly at the soft-bellied bulk of the chef. We went past him, the front of Diane's dress leaving a smear of blood on the front of his tunic. I saw he wasn't coming with us, that he was turning toward the maitre d' instead, and wanted to warn him, wanted to tell him that wouldn't work, that it was the worst idea in the world and likely to be the last idea he ever had. But there was no time. "Hey," the chef said. "Hey, gee, what dis?" There was a heavy thud that made me think of the sound of the knife burying itself in Humboldt's skull. And then the cook screamed. It had a watery sound. It was followed by a thick, wet splat that haunts my dreams. I don't know what it was, and I don't want to know. I yanked Diane down a narrow aisle between two stoves that baked a furious dull heat out at us. There was a door at the end, locked shut by two heavy steel bolts. I reached for the top one and then heard Guy, the maitre d' from hell, coming after us, babbling. I wanted to keep at the bolt, wanted to believe I could open the door and get us outside before he could get within sticking distance. But part of me, the part that was determined to live, knew better. I pushed Diane against the door, stepped in front of her in a protective maneuver that must go all the way back to the Ice Age, and faced him. He came running up the narrow aisle between the stoves, with the knife gripped in his left hand and raised above his head. His mouth was open and pulled back from a set of dingy, eroded teeth. Any hope of help I might have had from Gimple the Fool disappeared. He was cowering against the wall beside the door to the restaurant. His fingers were buried deep inside his mouth, and he looked more like the village idiot than ever. "Forgetful of me, you shouldn't have been," Gee screamed, sounding like Yoda in the Star Wars movies. "You're a hateful dog. Your loud music so disharmonious. Eee! How you ever?" There was a large pot on one of the front burners of the left-hand stove. I reached out for it and slapped it at him. It was over an hour before I realized how badly I'd burned my hand doing that. I had a palm full of blisters like little buns, and more blisters on my three middle fingers. The pot skidded off its burner and tipped over in midair, dousing Ghee from the waist down with what looked like corn, rice, and maybe 2 gallons of boiling water. He screamed, staggered backward, and put the hand that wasn't holding the knife down on the other stove, almost directly into the blue-yellow gas flame underneath a skillet where mushrooms, which had been sautéing, were now turning to charcoal. He screamed again, this time in a register so high it hurt my ears, and held his hand up before his eyes, as if not able to believe it was connected to him. I looked to my right and saw a little nestle of cleaning equipment beside the door. Glass-X and Clorox and janitor in a drum on a shelf, a broom with a dustpan stuck on top of the handle like a hat, and a mop in a steel bucket with a squeegee on the side. As Ghee came toward me again, holding the knife in the hand that wasn't red and swelling up like an inner tube, I grabbed the handle of the mop, used it to roll the bucket in front of me on its little casters, and then jabbed it out at him. Ghee pulled back with his upper body but stood his ground. There was a peculiar twitching little smile on his lips. He looked like a dog who has forgotten, temporarily at least, how to snarl. He held the knife up in front of his face and made several mystic passes with it. The overhead fluorescence glimmered liquidly on the blade, where it wasn't caked with blood, that was. He didn't seem to feel any pain in his burned hand or in his legs, although they had been doused with boiling water and his tuxedo pants were spackled with rice. "Rotten bugger," Ghee said, making his mystic passes. He was like a crusader preparing to go into battle. If that was, you could imagine a crusader in a rice cake tux. "Kill you like I did your nasty barking dog." "I don't have a dog," I said. "I can't have a dog. It's in the lease." I think it was the only thing I said to him during the whole nightmare, and I'm not entirely sure I did say it out loud. It might only have been a thought. Behind him, I could see the chef struggling to his feet. He had one hand wrapped around the handle of the kitchen's big refrigerator and the other clapped to his blood-stained tunic, which was torn open across the swelling of his stomach in a big purple grin. He was doing his best to hold his plumbing in, but it was a battle he was losing. One loop of intestines, shiny and bruise-colored, already hung out, resting against his left side like some awful watch chain. Ghee feinted at me with his knife. I countered by shoving the mop bucket at him, and he drew back. I pulled it to me again and stood there with my hands wrapped around the wooden mop handle, ready to shove the bucket at him if he moved. Behind Ghee, the cook had managed to get all the way up. Slowly, like an invalid in early recovery from a serious operation, he started working his way down the aisle toward Gimple the Fool. I wished him well. "Undo those bolts," I said to Diane. "What?" "The bolts on the door. Undo them." "I can't move," she said. She was crying so hard I could barely understand her. "You're crushing me." I moved forward a little to give her room. Ghee bared his teeth at me, mock jabbed with the knife, then pulled it back, grinning his nervous, snarling little grin as I rolled the bucket at him again on its squeaky casters. "Bug-infested stinkpot," he said. He sounded like a man discussing the Mets' chances in the forthcoming campaign. Let's see you play your radio this loud now, Stinkpot. It gives you a change in your thinking, doesn't it? Boink! He jabbed. I rolled. But this time, he didn't pull back as far, and I realized he was nerving himself up. He meant to go for it, and soon. I could feel Diane's breasts brush against my back as she gasped for breath. I'd given her room, but she hadn't turned around to work the bolts. She was just standing there. Open the door, I told her, speaking out of the side of my mouth like a prison con. Pull the goddamn bolts, Diane. I can't, she sobbed. I can't. I don't have any strength in my hands. Make him stop, Stephen. Don't stand there talking with him. Make him stop. She was driving me insane. I really thought she was. You turn around and pull those bolts, Diane, or I'll just stand aside and let... Eee! He screamed and charged, waving and stabbing with his knife. I slammed the mop bucket forward with all the force I could muster and swept his legs out from under him. He howled and brought the knife down in a long, desperate stroke. Any closer and it would have torn off the tip of my nose. Then he landed spraddled awkwardly on widespread knees, with his face just above the mop-squeezing gadget hung on the side of the bucket. Perfect. I drove the mop head into the nape of his neck. The strings draggled down over the shoulders of his black jacket like a witch wig. His face slammed into the squeegee. I bent, grabbed the handle with my free hand, and clamped it shut. Gee shrieked with pain, the sound muffled by the mop. Pull those bolts, I screamed at Diane. Pull those bolts, you useless bitch. Pull. Thud. Something hard and pointed slammed into my left buttock. I staggered forward with a yell, more surprise than pain, I think, although it did hurt. I went to one knee and lost my hold on the squeegee handle. Gee pulled back, slipping out from under the stringy head of the mop at the same time, breathing so loudly he sounded almost as if he were barking. It hadn't slowed him down much, though. He lashed out at me with the knife as soon as he was clear of the bucket. I pulled back, feeling the breeze as the blade cut the air beside my cheek. It was only as I scrambled up that I realized what had happened, what she had done. I snatched a quick glance over my shoulder at her. She stared back defiantly, her back pressed against the door. A crazy thought came to me. She wanted me to get killed, had perhaps even planned it, the whole thing, found herself a crazy maitre d' and... Her eyes widened. Look out! I turned back just in time to see him lunging at me. The sides of his face were bright red, except for the big white spots made by the drain holes in the squeegee. I rammed the mop head at him, aiming for the throat and getting his chest instead. I stopped his charge and actually knocked him backward a step. What happened then was only luck. He slipped in water from the overturned bucket and went down hard, slamming his head on the tiles. Not thinking and just vaguely aware that I was screaming, I snatched up the skillet of mushrooms from the stove and brought it down on his upturned face as hard as I could. There was a muffled thump, followed by a horrible but mercifully brief hissing sound as the skin of his cheeks and forehead boiled. I turned, shoved Diane aside, and drew the bolts holding the door shut. I opened the door, and sunlight hit me like a hammer, and the smell of the air. I can't remember air ever smelling better, not even when I was a kid, and it was the first day of summer vacation. I grabbed Diane's arm and pulled her out into a narrow alley lined with padlocked trash bins. At the far end of this narrow stone slit, like a vision of heaven, was 53rd Street, with traffic going heedlessly back and forth. I looked over my shoulder and through the open kitchen door. Gee lay on his back with carbonized mushrooms circling his head like an existential diadem. The skillet had slid off to one side, revealing a face that was red and swelling with blisters. One of his eyes was open, but it looked unseeingly up at the fluorescent lights. Behind him, the kitchen was empty. There was a pool of blood on the floor and bloody handprints on the white enamel front of the walk-in fridge, but both the chef and Gimple the Fool were gone. I slammed the door shut and pointed down the alley. Go on. She didn't move, only looked at me. I shoved her lightly on her left shoulder. Go! She raised a hand like a traffic cop, shook her head, then pointed a finger at me. Don't you touch me! What'll you do, sick your lawyer on me? I think he's dead, sweetheart. Don't you patronize me like that. Don't you dare, and don't you touch me, Stephen. I'm warning you. The kitchen door burst open. Moving, not thinking, but just moving, I slammed it shut again. I leaned my back against it and braced my feet. Do you want to stand here and discuss it? I asked her. He's still pretty lively by the sound. He hit the door again. I rocked with it, then slammed it shut. I waited for him to try again, but he didn't. Diane gave me a long look, glary and uncertain, and then started walking up the alleyway with her head down and her hair hanging at the sides of her neck. I stood with my back against the door until she got about 3/4 of the way to the street, then stood away from it, watching it warily. No one came out, but I decided that wasn't going to guarantee any peace of mind. I dragged one of the trash bins in front of the door, then set off after Diane, jogging. When I got to the mouth of the alley, she wasn't there anymore. I looked right toward Madison and didn't see her. I looked left, and there she was, wandering slowly across 53rd on a diagonal, her head still down and her hair still hanging like curtains at the sides of her face. No one paid any attention to her. The people in front of the Gotham Cafe were gawking through the plate glass windows like people in front of the New England Aquarium shark tank at feeding time. Sirens were approaching, a lot of them. I went across the street, reached for her shoulder, thought better of it. I settled for calling her name instead. She turned around, her eyes dulled with horror and shock. The front of her dress had turned into a grisly purple bib. She stank of blood and spent adrenaline. "Leave me alone," she said. "I never want to see you again, Stephen." "You kicked my ass in there," I said. "You kicked my ass and almost got me killed. Both of us. I can't believe you, Diane." "I've wanted to kick your ass for the last 14 months, she said. "When it comes to fulfilling our dreams, we can't always pick our times, can we?" I slapped her across the face. I didn't think about it, I just did it, and few things in my adult life have given me so much pleasure. I'm ashamed of that, but I've come too far in this story to tell a lie, even one of omission. Her head rocked back. Her eyes widened in shock and pain, losing that dull, traumatized look. "You bastard!" she cried, her hand going to her cheek. Now tears were brimming in her eyes. "Oh, you bastard!" "I saved your life," I said. "Don't you realize that? Doesn't that get through? I saved your fucking life." "You son of a bitch," she whispered. "You controlling, judgmental, small-minded, conceited, complacent son of a bitch. I hate you." "Did you even hear me? If it wasn't for the conceited, small-minded son of a bitch, you'd be dead now. If it wasn't for you, I wouldn't have been there in the first place," she said, as the first 3 police cars came screaming down 53rd Street and pulled up in front of the Gotham Cafe. Cops poured out of them like clowns in a circus act. "If you ever touch me again, I'll scratch your eyes out, Steve," she said. "Stay away from me." I had to put my hands in my armpits. They wanted to kill her, to reach out and wrap themselves around her neck and just kill her. She walked 7 or 8 steps, then turned back to me. She was smiling. It was a terrible smile, more awful than any expression I had seen on the face of Guy, the demon waiter. "I had lovers," she said, smiling her terrible smile. She was lying. The lie was all over her face, but that didn't make the lie hurt any less. She wished it was true. That was all over her face, too. 3 of them over the last year or so. You weren't any good at it, so I found men who were. She turned and walked down the street, like a woman who is 65 instead of 27. I stood and watched her. Just before she reached the corner, I shouted it again. It was the one thing I couldn't get past. It was stuck in my throat like a chicken bone. "I saved your life! Your goddamn life!" She paused at the corner and turned back to me. The terrible smile was still on her face. "No," she said, "you didn't." Then she went on around the corner. I haven't seen her since, although I suppose I will. I'll see her in court, as the saying goes. I found a market on the next block and bought a package of Marlboros. When I got back to the corner of Madison and 53rd, 53rd had been blocked off with those blue sawhorses the cops used to protect crime scenes and parade routes. I could see the restaurant, though. I could see it just fine. I sat down on the curb, lit a cigarette, and observed developments. Half a dozen rescue vehicles arrived, a scream of ambulances, I guess you could say. The chef went into the first one, unconscious but apparently still alive. His brief appearance before his fans on 53rd Street was followed by a body bag on a stretcher, Humboldt. Next came Guy, strapped tightly to a stretcher and staring wildly around as he was loaded into the back of an ambulance. I thought that for just a moment his eyes met mine, but that was probably just my imagination. As Guy's ambulance pulled away, rolling through a hole in the sawhorse barricade provided by two uniformed cops, I tossed the cigarette I'd been smoking in the gutter. I hadn't gone through this day just to start killing myself with tobacco again, I decided. I looked after the departing ambulance and tried to imagine the man inside it living wherever maitre d's live. Queens or Brooklyn or maybe even Rye or Mamaroneck. I tried to imagine what his own dining room might look like, what pictures might be on the walls. I couldn't do that, but I found I could imagine his bedroom with relative ease, although not whether he shared it with a woman. I could see him lying awake, but perfectly still, looking up at the ceiling in the small hours, while the moon hung in the black firmament like the half-lidded eye of a corpse. I could imagine him lying there and listening to the neighbor's dog bark steadily and monotonously, going on and on until the sound was like a silver nail driving into his brain. I imagined him lying not far from a closet filled with tuxedos and plastic dry-cleaning bags. I could see them hanging there in the dark like executed felons. I wondered if he did have a wife. If so, had he killed her before coming to work? I thought of the blob on his shirt and decided it was a possibility. I also wondered about the neighbor's dog, the one that wouldn't shut up, and the neighbor's family. But mostly it was Guy I thought about, lying sleepless through all the same nights I had lain sleepless, listening to the dog next door or down the street as I had listened to sirens and the rumble of trucks heading downtown. I thought of him lying there and looking up at the shadows the moon had tacked to the ceiling. Thought of that cry, yee, building up in his head like gas in a closed room. Yee, I said, just to see how it sounded. I dropped the package of Marlboros into the gutter and began stamping it methodically as I sat there on the curb. Yee, yee, yee. One of the cops standing by the sawhorses looked over at me. Hey, buddy, want to stop being a pain in the butt? He called over. We got us a situation here. Of course you do, I thought. Don't we all? I didn't say anything, though. I stopped stamping. The cigarette pack was pretty well flattened by then anyway, and stopped making the noise. I could still hear it in my head, though, and why not? It makes as much sense as anything else. Eee. Eee.